funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
If you want to be happy, be true to yourself. We've all heard that advice, and many of us have put real effort into trying to find and honor that true self within us. But what if your true self doesn't actually exist? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The drive for self-discovery and self-actualization might seem universal, but in fact, they are Western concepts. Ancient Chinese philosophers mapped a very different road to success and fulfillment in a social climate that looked very much like our own. People worried about fraying human relationships, the effects of self-absorption, and wondering how different kinds of people could live together in peace. The names Confucius, Mencius, Zhuangzi, and Laozi may be just vaguely familiar to those of us steeped in Western culture, but my guest believes their ideas can be incredibly valuable for building good and satisfying lives, from the smallest interactions to our grandest ambitions. Michael Pewitt is professor of Chinese history at Harvard University. His new book, written with Christine Gross Lowe, is called The Path: What Chinese Philosophers Can Teach Us About the Good Life. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
The book is based on your class, which is among the most popular classes taught anywhere at Harvard. Your students are the best of the best, according to the way we judge college applicants in this country. What is it they need from Chinese philosophy?
Well, I think a lot of them find they've been, as you said, very, very high achieving. Things have gone well for them. But a lot of them feel that they're not really quite sure about what they want to do with the next stage of their life. And even more importantly, I think a lot feel that the mantra they hear, that they should be finding themselves, being authentic to themselves, doesn't seem to really be working. And I found it's a generation that's very open to extremely different ideas.
Do they sense that their lives need a different direction or a different dimension when they arrive in your class?
I think at a deep level they do. The reason I put it that way is I think most, if you ask them as they walk in the door, what are you spending these 4 years doing, they probably would say, oh, I'm trying to find myself and I want to be true and sincere to my real authentic self. So I think they take that rhetoric, but at a deep level they're not terribly happy, which is why I think they also find it both very counterintuitive and challenging but very exciting to be told, well, there are different ways to think.
Before we talk about those different ways to think, I want to get a sense of the world in which these philosophies were created and refined. What was China like 2,500 years ago?
So very much as you mentioned at the beginning, it's an age not unlike our own. So it's an age that was perceived to be one of great promise but also tremendous conflict. Hmm. It's an age in which you had the end of an earlier great aristocratic age, not unlike us when we look back on, say, what things were like in the 18th century. They were in the midst of dramatic social change and transformation, not unlike what we call the modern era. And they, too, were wondering what to do. How do you create a better world? How do you think of the self? So a lot of their questions were very similar to ours. And intriguingly, a lot of their answers, in some cases, were quite similar, too. But the ones that kind of make it in the Chinese tradition are actually quite different.
How did Chinese philosophers teach one another from one generation to the next and challenge one another's ideas? Were they getting together and practicing something like the Socratic method? How did they communicate?
It was a very intense debate culture. So they would indeed get together, debate issues, write texts against each other. It was a period when there was a sense that we don't quite know what the best approach is. And an intense debate ensued as to, therefore, what to do.
In the West, we believe talent and intelligence are innate. What does Chinese philosophy say about those things?
One of the things that's fascinating about Chinese philosophers is they will argue consistently that all of us at birth are kind of the same. Now, we're the same both in a good and bad sense. In a bad sense, we're kind of messy bunches of uncultivated stuff, including very selfish desires, etc. But we all equally have potentials to be much more than that. And so the idea is don't think about who you are at birth, what your talents are, what your gifts are. The focus is always what can you become.
The idea that we should be true to ourselves seems like something that everyone the world over believes and should believe, as if it's like an innate human value. In fact, that would make no sense whatsoever to an ancient Chinese philosopher.
None. It's one of the things that's so striking when you read these texts, because as you said, we so take these for granted that, of course, that's what we should do. We have a true self that we should try to find and be authentic to. And it's very striking to come upon an entire world of philosophy where the major position is, no, we're messy selves and we are just a bunch of really, really complex stuff. And our goal is to work on that and change that and become something better than what we think we are.
So what do we miss out if we focus our energy on trying to find ourselves? What are we neglecting to notice?
Well, their argument is that if we are, again, these very, very messy selves, what will tend to happen is we are constantly being pulled in different directions by people we meet, things we encounter. And from a very young age, we fall into sort of patterns and ruts of responses. And those patterns can continue over a lifetime, oftentimes in very destructive ways to us and certainly to those around us. And if they're onto something here, and I most certainly think they are, then, of course, if you try to look within and find your true self, what if you're just finding a bunch of patterns that you've fallen into? And when you say, oh, I'm just the sort of person who's good at this, but I just get angry at little things, that could be an accurate statement right now, but the goal is not then to be authentic to that and embrace it. The goal is to change those patterns and become a better person.
Reading this book, I was thinking a lot about my lifelong interest in psychological profiles like the Myers-Briggs personality type indicator.
Yes.
And I realized that that's psychology, and you're talking about philosophy here, but Western psychology has clearly been influenced by Western philosophy.
Completely. One of the things that struck me when I first started reading these texts is the degree to which things I just took for granted were, in fact, Western philosophical conceptions and very questionable ones. As you said, the Myers-Briggs test assumes we are a thing, and the goal of the test is to figure out who you are and then what you'd be good at in your career, what sorts of relationships you should be in. And again, what if that's wrong? What if we're not just one thing? And what if we're constraining ourselves by trying to embrace this one thing that we happen to be at the moment we take a Myers-Briggs test?
So if we consider our ways of being as habits rather than reflections of something about our fixed character, how does that create more space for us to improve ourselves?
Well, the key would be if we are, as you said, habitual creatures, we're just creatures of habit repeating these patterns endlessly, then it also means they're changeable. And if we're constantly being pulled in different directions by people we encounter, it means we could relate to them differently and not respond in the same ways. So their focus would be, well, work on these. So work on these patterns, alter these patterns, begin to embrace the world in a very, very different way, to build relationships in a very different way. So if we're patterned, the key is those patterns are alterable.
You place this huge emphasis, based on your scholarship, on the importance of small interactions. If we hope to lead fulfilling lives and make the world a better place in some grand way, why think about the encounter with the person who checks us out at the grocery store or the neighbor we pass on the street but don't even speak to?
Absolutely. I mean, here too, we tend to think, well, if I'm going to look within and find myself, that's what my focus should be. And as you said, how I greet someone on the street is irrelevant. These philosophers would say, no, it's the really mundane stuff, our sort of everyday interactions. That's where we both become what we have become in time, these patterned creatures, and also how we change it. So little things like the way you smile at someone, the way you walk across a room, the way you greet someone, actually, those are part of the patterns you've fallen into. And by changing those even a little bit, you can begin to change those patterns. You can feel the difference almost immediately, and something so seemingly insignificant can actually be the beginning of very dramatic change.
Another thing that this book made me think about is that, you know, I have certainly said to people, I'm not a morning person, leave me alone before I've had my coffee before this hour. But years ago, I had a job where I had to be at work and ready to go and showered and everything, you know, by 5 a.m. And
yes,
somehow I made that happen. So it's clearly not a fixed thing. It's just a pattern that I've fallen into.
Absolutely. Yet we all have these. Oh, I just am not a morning person. I just work best in the late afternoon, or I don't work best in the late afternoon. That's when I sleep. Actually, as you said, these are simply habits we've fallen into. So accurate statements for the moment, but completely changeable.
So we can make anything true about ourselves if we're willing to put in the work to change our habits.
Yes. I mean, one of the key things they will focus on is it's all about work, training, but work and training in an exciting sense, because you can feel the difference almost immediately.
We're speaking this hour with Michael Pewitt, who is professor of Chinese history at Harvard University and author of the new book, The Path, What Chinese Philosophers Can Teach Us About the Good Life. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. We welcome you to join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. And I'm checking Twitter. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink, so feel free to communicate with me there.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can customize your master's degree to distinguish yourself in the workplace. You can apply now for summer. Deadline is May 1st. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Harvard University professor of Chinese history Michael Pewitt, co-author of the new book, The Path, What Chinese Philosophers Can Teach Us About the Good Life. You can join this conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So many interesting people that I was introduced to in this book. Mencius was really fascinating to me. He had this sense that the world was kind of a mess and would continue to be a mess, which would sound really depressing, and yet he felt that there was reason for optimism.
Absolutely true. So if we are messy selves, as a lot of the philosophers were arguing, Mencius said, well, and in truth, the world is kind of messy too. It's consisting of lots of messy people around us. The world is very capricious. And we like to think, oh, no, I should assume it's a stable world and make plans accordingly. He argued, no, if it sounds depressing to think of it as a capricious world, that also means it's very changeable. And you, with these little things you can do, can alter it in fairly dramatic ways.
It's natural for people dealing with troubled relationships to just wish the other person would change, right? This is how we wish the world would work. Chinese philosophy suggests we would do better to look at our own behavior, which is within our control.
Yes. So often in relationships, we think, well, this relationship isn't working because I'm me, that person is that person, and we just don't work well together. And they would say, well, realize if the other person is doing things that you don't like, it is a relationship, and probably little things you're doing are affecting that person negatively, which are in turn affecting you negatively, and then these dangerous patterns set in, which also means, if that's the depressing way of putting it, little changes can alter that. So if someone does something that makes you angry in a relationship, start altering how you respond. And very quickly, you'll get a sense of what little things you're doing that is bringing out a certain type of a response. You'll start altering those, working with those, and you'll be stunned at how quickly relationships can actually improve.
It's interesting because we tend to believe if someone has done something to make us angry that they deserve to be punished by our anger. But that almost never, changes the behaviors of the other person in the ways that we might like.
Absolutely. Almost always that will make the pattern worse. So if someone makes us angry, we yell back. Of course, that's only going to make them angrier and build up the resentment, which at some point is going to come out again as anger, to which we respond. And you'll get into these patterns that, again, can last years or, sadly, even decades. And all of that can be altered. These little tiny things you begin doing to break that, it's amazing the difference. I mean, there's a reason when people get angry at us. And, yeah, it's things that they're doing, but it's often things we're doing, too, and they're changeable.
You're not suggesting here that we just take whatever comes and sort of roll over and, allow ourselves to be abused. This is about creating a dynamic.
Yes. One of the things that's so intriguing about these philosophers is they will say, think of all of these relationships as extremely dynamic and changeable. So our danger is we tend not to think they're changeable. And their goal is to say, don't just become comfortable with the world you're living in. Train yourself to alter situations for the better. And these little things we do are the ways you begin to alter them.
What do we have to do? What kind of practice is required to achieve what you call trained spontaneity, which is such a funny term to me?
Indeed. So we tend to think we know how to be spontaneous, right? We just take out a moment and break conventions and do whatever we want to do. And they would say, well, no, that's probably just falling into some, well, pattern or fulfilling some desire. And it makes no difference because it just, you then return to doing your standard old patterns after that. So what they mean by train spontaneity is you are training the way you're acting in the world, but it ultimately becomes spontaneous because it just becomes such a part of your way of being. Think of it like learning a musical instrument or learning a sport that takes lots of work. But once you get it, after these years of training, you spontaneously can play a piano. You spontaneously can play basketball. But their spontaneity is something you've achieved. And think of your life that way. Mm-hmm. You're training yourself to actually spontaneously work in the world as opposed to simply repeating these same standard patterns.
It sounds a little bit like learning to read. If you can remember back that far,
yes.
It wasn't very much fun until suddenly words just sort of crystallized in front of your eyes because you knew them by sight.
Precisely. And the irony is we tend to accept skill-based things like reading, learning a musical instrument as things we admit we have to put in a little bit of time and work into, but the results are great. Ironically, we almost never think this way about our lives. But imagine we did. Imagine just the ways we are interacting in the world was the same sort of thing, where we would be training ourselves to work well with it.
I don't know if you ever have students say, well, this sounds a little manipulative. If I'm only taking these actions to hope that someone does things the way that I like or to make things easier for me, is that somehow unethical?
Well, the key they would say, and I really think there's something to this, that when you're training yourself to sense how things you do affect others and why it is that when people do things, they affect us in often negative ways too, when you're training yourself, what you're really learning to do is to sense people and sense situations well. And when you're truly doing that, you end up acting in ways not simply to help yourself, which again, in the long run, is equally going to be another pattern that will be very destructive. What you're really doing is working to create situations in which everyone around you is flourishing. So, you know, going back to your question about the angry person, if you're altering that situation, hopefully that person can interact with you just as you can interact with that person well, and the entire relationship is going to be dramatically altered for the better.
It sounds like train spontaneity is maybe a different way of defining wisdom. You know, you get to a certain point in your life and you've gone through something enough times to know that if you do this, this is likely to happen. And if you do that, there's likely to be a different outcome. And then you have the self-control to act, you know, appropriately.
Yes, that's a beautiful way of putting it. I mean, the disciples of Confucius, he's one of these great sages, will often describe him exactly this way, that he's simply become someone who spontaneously acts in ways that brings out the best in everyone around him. Hmm. And the goal is to say, well, this is what we should all be striving to do, to simply spontaneously sense situations perfectly such that we could always be acting in ways that will bring out the best. Not that we'll all, of course, achieve this, but the point is that would be a life goal.
How does Chinese philosophy stack the good of the individual as compared with the good of the larger community?
Yeah, great question. Their argument is you're really not going to have happy individuals unless you're creating great communities. You just can't get one without the other because by definition, if you're simply thinking about yourself, you're again going to create these very, very dangerous interactions with those around you, which in the long run is going to be destructive, certainly for them, but even for you too. So they would say, no, you're always focusing on these relationships, improving these relationships, and by doing those, you create great friendships, great families, great communities, great societies. And the more you can do it in a way that in which everyone can flourish, you, by definition, too, are going to be a much, much better person.
So, Michael, help me understand this. Chinese philosophy seems to tell us to really watch our habits. And at the same time, it tells us to embrace ritual.
Yes. So we tend to think ritual is just a perfect example of these archaic things that people had to do in traditional societies because rituals tell us what to do. And we like to think, again, we're individuals who can decide for ourselves. But the intriguing thing is maybe it's kind of the opposite. So maybe they're right that we really are just these patterned creatures. And if that's true, then what rituals are doing is they're breaking those patterns. So in rituals as they perceive them, What that really means is for a brief moment, you become a different person, interacting with those around you in a different way. Those breaks the normal patterns you're falling into and gives you the possibility of training yourself. And by rituals, they even mean just the little things like how we greet someone. For that brief moment, just if you really do it ritually, you actually are greeting them, you're sensing the other person, you're breaking out of your standard patterns, and over time, that can have a huge impact.
What did Confucius mean when he talked about trying to live our lives as if the world were already a perfect place?
Yes. So one of their notions of rituals is think of rituals as if spaces. So you're acting as if it's different from the world you're really living in. And so if you're in a world of one set of patterns, in a ritual space, you act as if you're, on the contrary, in a world in which everyone is relating very well to each other. And it's not that that's true. By definition, it's not. It's that that break is what really matters. Because in that ritual moment, again, even with the greeting, you're developing the sort of emotions and dispositions of what it would mean to really relate to another human being well. And by doing that, you're training yourself to be able to actually do so even when you're not greeting someone.
So maybe this shouldn't matter because it comes down to focus on ourselves or on the individual, but it's a little hard for us to entirely divorce ourselves from our sort of natural narcissism. Do these actions, these little moments of generosity and spontaneous, you know, concern for other people, do they still reward us in some way, even if for some reason they don't yield the pattern of reciprocated generosity?
Absolutely. What they would argue, and again, I think they're completely onto something here, is that when we're always self-absorbed, that's always in the long run also self-destructive because we're only focusing on ourselves, we're only focusing on what's good for us. In the long run, that creates very dangerous relationships with those around us, and that will always harm us in the long run. If, on the contrary, you're constantly trying to build these better relationships, you yourself will not only, by definition, be a better person, but you'll be incomparably happier, incomparably more joyous, and yes, even incomparably more successful because you'll be so good at working with and developing relationships with those around you.
We're speaking this hour with Harvard University professor of Chinese history, Michael Pewitt. His new book, written with Christine Gross Lowe, is called The Path, What Chinese Philosophers Can Teach Us About the Good Life. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Harvard University professor of Chinese history, Michael Pewitt, co-author of the new book, The Path, What Chinese Philosophers Can Teach Us About the Good Life. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, which is where we hear from John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. I just wanted to ask how one would begin to build these relationships that you're talking about and kind of start the rejuvenation of life, if you will.
Wonderful question, John. Thank you. And the nice thing about these philosophers is they're very practical and they will say begin with very doable small things. So, for example, you walk onto a bus in the morning, you're tired, you're exhausted, you're angry at the bad things that just happen to you on the way in. You walk on the bus and sort of take your usual seat and grumbling to yourself. The little act at that moment of simply smiling at the bus driver as you walk by, that little act, you'll notice immediately that will draw out a slightly different response from him than the usual sort of frowned anger that we'll walk onto a bus with. That little change, seemingly insignificant, is actually significant because you'll catch how little things you're doing are affecting others. Then you keep doing things like that throughout the day. changing slightly how you interact with people, if you have a bad relationship at work or at home, begin altering things you do, and slowly but surely you'll begin to catch why it is that little things make one angry, or why it is that people around you are in a bad mood, and slight things you can do that can begin to affect how you're feeling, how they're feeling. And over time, what you're really training yourself to do is to see that, yeah, most of our relationships in life are just caused by these dangerous ways we interact with the world, how we're responding to the world, how we're interacting. And as you begin to alter those, you'll begin to see it brings out incredibly different responses in yourself and those around you. And I mean, within a few weeks, you'll begin to notice the difference. It's extraordinary how these little changes add up to very significant changes in the long run.
What's remarkable is this idea that as we are being kinder to other people within the world and trying to be a little more understanding, what we're doing on the inside is filing away those hypersensitivities so that we're not so bothered if somebody snubs us, or we're not so envious of a friend's promotion, that sort of thing. We're actually doing things for other people, and then on the inside, we're just not as upset as we used to be by little things.
Absolutely. I mean, they would say you literally are becoming a different person. And so these little things that make us angry, or that make us jealous or resentful, there's no reason for that. These are trained responses we've fallen into, and they're changeable. And as you begin to alter how you're acting in the world, how you're experiencing the world, you quickly find that these little things cease to anger you. And then it's striking how much of our lives end up being kind of defined by these little angers and fears and resentments and anxieties. And you literally start becoming a different person once you begin breaking out of those patterns.
I think when we approach things in the West that are a big goal, we look forward to the ultimate day when we have achieved it and we can quit trying. But it doesn't sound like Chinese philosophy is really pushing you to get to the mountain and stop, but to recognize that you'll be climbing your entire life.
It's one of the great things that they argue, that think of this as a lifelong process. And as you said, you never get to the top of the mountain. We're always training ourselves to be better human beings. We're always failing by definition, but then you learn from those errors and you grow. And the image they'll give is to say, think of your life as what you're trying to be as a sage. A sage would be someone who could just perfectly in any situation act in ways that would bring out the best in her or himself and those around one all the time. Now, again, we'll never get there. But the more you do that, the more you work toward that, the more joyous you and everyone around you will in fact be. And it's a great life goal, even though, again, it's in a literal sense unachievable, but you become an incomparably better person through the process.
How did the philosophers you studied gauge their own moral and ethical goodness, their own sort of fitness in terms of how they are in the world?
Well, they thought a lot in terms of communities. And so the idea is you're constantly striving to be good, but you're learning from those around you. So Confucius would often say things like, well, every time I'm with another human being, I'm trying to be good to them, but I'm also trying to learn from them. And so the idea is you try to build these communities in which you're trying to be good, that hopefully brings out the best in others. And what you're really being judged on is the degree to which you can forge these great relationships with those around you. And again, we're learning from their attempts as well.
So this is no disrespect whatsoever to your students at Harvard. I should be so lucky as to have my kids go there, and they won't. But how does all this play out for students who have entered college? And I don't mean to generalize entirely, but students who have entered college with the sense that they are there to get the knowledge and skills required to give them a really lucrative career, to be, you know, cutthroat investment bankers, that sort of thing. What happens when they have taken all these ideas and considered them? Are they all changing their majors?
Some change their majors. Not all do. I mean, you can also, of course, go into any type of a career. And regardless, you will be incomparably better at it, I would argue, if you take some of these ideas seriously. And so you'll be incomparably better at working in an office and building relationships with people by doing this. So I can say without any question, the single most gratifying thing for me as a teacher is years later, I will get these emails from students, or by then, you know, former students many years before, who will literally say, you know, my lives were fundamentally changed by these ideas, sometimes because they picked another major, but much more significantly because they simply began to live their life in a different way, which over time, again, had a huge impact on the entire ways that they were interacting with others, developing a career. These are really life-changing ideas.
Are you also providing them with some kind of framework for coping with inevitable failure at some stage in their lives? If students, you know, have raced through, you know, elementary and high school and gotten to Harvard, they probably haven't failed a whole lot.
Yes. I mean, one of the things these philosophers will teach constantly is the world is fundamentally capricious and horrible things are going to happen to us. Totally unexpected things. We'll think everything is going well for us. We have a perfect plan. Inevitably, things will happen that will break that plan just because the world is more complex than our grand plans will ever be. And so part of what you're doing when you're training yourself to interact well in the world, you're also training yourself to deal with the inevitable setbacks and failures and oftentimes horrible things that will happen to us. And if you're training yourself well, then hopefully you're going to be much better at responding to those in even powerful and effective ways in the long run, despite, you know, the horrible things that truly can happen to us.
If you believe in a world that is capricious, if not outright unjust, where does compassion come in? If you come to accept that you will be affected by things that are not really your fault but have negatively affected you, and you have to find a way to live with that, what do you do with the suffering of someone else?
Well, the great thing is, if that's the way the world is, and I think they're right that it fundamentally is, it really is capricious, then the focus is changing the things you can change. And ironically, they would say, we can actually change much more than we tend to think we can change. And so thinking the world is capricious really focuses on how I can really build these great relationships. So with your example, if I see something unjust, maybe that really is something I can change. If not immediately, maybe I can help build a better world in which that sort of thing would be much less likely to happen. And so once you realize it's a capricious world based on these dangerous patterns, those are alterable. It's true for us with our immediate relationships. It's true for human society in general. It's all much more changeable than we tend to like to think.
Are the ideas of ancient Chinese philosophers actively practiced in China today? Are they simply part of a culture, or are people giving deliberate thought to pursuing a good life this way?
It's a very exciting moment in Chinese history. So for much of the 20th century, these ideas were actively rejected. There was an attempt, of course, to build a completely different society, a communist society, and all of these ideas were actively suppressed. Now, much more recently, by which I mean literally the past 5 to 10 years, there's been a consciousness in China that there's been a loss of values and that these ideas should come back. And the result is, yes, they are hotly being debated. So there's a huge blogosphere in China. All of these ideas are back. People are actively debating them again. It's a very exciting moment.
Michael Pewitt is professor of Chinese history at Harvard University. His new book, written with Christine Gross Lowe, is called The Path: What Chinese Philosophers Can Teach Us About the Good Life. Michael, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you very much for making time for us.
A total pleasure. Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington.